What will turn the hearts of people toward God? Hello and welcome to Good Word. I am Dave Thomas. This is the last week in which we have lessons where we've been looking at the rhythms of life as they play out in family life. This week's lesson is actually connected to the famous passage in the book of Malachi, Malachi 4, 5 and 6, that says, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." Now, I'm happy to have my conversation partners, Bram Berglund and Jen Ogden. And by the way, let me thank you for the 13 weeks that you've been willing to be engaged. It's been a joy.
It's a delight.
It's been a good synergy here, and it's, I think we've even had fun doing this. But
yeah.
This is an interesting text to kind of end the quarter on, and as I read it, I used it as a springboard to think about what it is that might turn the hearts of people toward each other, and above that, their hearts toward God. And in talking about that, there are a couple of occasions that came to my mind, biblical stories that I think we can talk about here a little bit to make the point. The first one is found in 1 Kings 18, the famous story of Elijah on Mount Carmel. And I don't know if either one of you want to set that scene up for us. Jen, you are talking about it, especially one part that was your favorite. You want to get...
Well, there's a competition, isn't there, between prophets and priests of different religions, and Elijah being the prophet of God, and the priests of Baal being the priests of Baal, both of them trying to prove whose God was best and biggest and most capable. And, oh, Elijah, he's a provoker, and I appreciate this about him quite a bit. But he you know, the prophets of Baal are out there dancing and screaming and hollering and trying to get fire to fall from their God.
From the God who was in charge of fire, by the way.
Yeah. And he just, he forgot his matchbook that day. It was not happening. And Elijah was very careful to point that out to them. Like, hello, he's just, you know, he's not there. You got to wake him up, shake louder, scream harder.
He
totally mocked them. He was hilariously mean.
It's a little bit of prophetic smack talk.
Yeah, it was. And then, of course, when he prays to God, fire comes and consumes not just the stones or the wood, the wet wood, but the stones as well.
Yeah. And this actually was in a time of gross idolatry, was it not?
Yeah.
Ahab and Jezebel were the northern king. Ahab of the 10 tribes in the north of Israel had married a Sidonian princess, Jezebel, and she, of course, brought with her all of her own gods and Ashtoreth and Baal and the rituals that came with it.
Yeah, the religion she imported was a fertility religion.
Absolutely.
And it was immediately attractive to the Israelites. Mm-hmm. And so they all depart from the narrow way of following God, and they go into all the stuff, and you have a showdown, and I like the way you described that. You know, and I pictured it in my mind here. One lone prophet up against about 400.
Yeah.
Right? And the 400 have the whole day to do their thing, and they don't get anything. And then Elijah... And by the way, I like the part where he keeps an eye on them to make sure they don't start the fire themselves.
They don't have a little Zippo hidden in their gown.
And this results now, you know, the dramatic display of God's power, the fire coming down, it precipitates a rather significant departure from idolatry, some of which was enforced, by the way, to a period of following after God. You know, and that's one of the stories that intrigued me to some extent. And the other one is the story of John the Baptist. And I happen to like John the Baptist. I especially like it because of Luke, the third chapter, where you read. And of course, I should preface it by pointing out that there was 400 years of prophetic silence before John the Baptist comes. And people were very worried that the voice of God had gone quiet, at least the prophetic voice. And you know, I like Luke 3 where Luke reflects on all the big shots of the day, Tiberius, Caesar, you know, and goes on down all the way to Annas and Caiaphas, the chief high priest and company. And, you know, when you read that, if you think about it, it sounds like he's setting out all the names on whose side the future lay. You know, if God is going to do anything, it's going to be with these people and the great structures they have made. And, you know, while you're contemplating that, you get to the next verse that is a shocking verse because it says that the word of the Lord, in this time, the word of the Lord came to John the Baptist in the wilderness. And you hit yourself on the side of the head and say, wait a minute. Here is this whole structure that is governing and presiding over society, which has now essentially become idolatrous. And where does God go? He goes to this bright-eyed, sharp-tongued, fearless peasant who comes out of the wilderness with an announcement, okay, that, hey, people, pay attention. And I think his words are something that now is an axe laid to the root of this tree. You've grown a big tree, but it really is an idolatrous tree, and it's coming down now. Mm-hmm. And it's no wonder that the man was soon in trouble for calling out Herod for his misbehavior, and lo and behold, he's beheaded.
And Dave, if I can say a word about the passage that you read earlier about Malachi saying that Elijah will come, it isn't just coincidental that the language that both Matthew and Mark use, Matthew 3 verse 4 and Mark 1 verse 6, describe John wearing a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist. And when you look at that detail and you think, well, that's a funny thing to say. But then when you go back to the book of Kings and this mad prophet shows up in the court of Ahab and says, there's not going to be any rain for 3.5 years until you understand who's God. And he says, well, what kind of guy was this who showed up in my palace? And his courtiers said, oh, it was a man with a leather belt around his waist and wearing a hairy garment. It's like, oh, that was Elijah.
Well, that guy.
Yeah, that guy. And he was recognized by his dress. And John the Baptist wears the exact same clothing.
So that would have been a link that any student of the
Old Testament would have recognized right away. It's like, yeah, this is the new Elijah. He's come in the wilderness and he's announcing. What's interesting is while the first one announced 3.5 years of famine, this one is announcing the coming of a 3.5 year ministry of the Messiah, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is. But he's also announcing the inauguration of a whole new age.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. And, to go back to Malachi, it seems to me that passage, when you read it, it creates a longing in a believer's heart to see a day when, in the midst of the tumult of life, there will be something that calls people back to God. And I suppose every generation has thought of their era as being particularly sinful and adulterous. I think we tend to think of our own era that way. But this idea of a longing to see the relationships between parents and children, between children and parents, between people and God healed, it's a longing that I know has long been part of my experience. And I wonder what you think about that. Or is there something human beings can do to enable that? Is it beyond us? Is this a silly dream that exists?
Well, I might be reading this far too narrowly in a sense, but I do find it interesting that it says he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to their fathers. And maybe, Jen, you could say something about this, who's someone who works with families and young children. Why wouldn't it say the parents here, of father and mother to the children? Is it because mothers' hearts tend to be already drawn directly to their children? What is it maybe, and I'm speaking as a father, what is it about fathers that maybe we are less naturally drawn to our children than the mother is? And am I reading too much into this?
Maybe. I mean, I think this is written in an extremely patriarchal society where the significant person in the family was the man. So I think that maybe we are reading it a little more gender specific there. And this is definitely about reconciliation of relationship. And I think we can see it in a broader context. And you could see fathers, sometimes you can even understand in the text of the day where they said fathers meaning parents. So I think we can understand it in a broader sense.
But when I read Ephesians chapter 5, for instance, and it says, fathers, don't exasperate your children.
Well, that's totally true. Yeah. Well, definitely talking about dad.
Well, right. No, I think so. Because, okay, all you got to do is look up on YouTube a really quick thing, fathers messing with their children, and dads play the most horrible tricks on their children. Yeah.
And rough games.
And I've been guilty of that as well. And my children grew up hearing that verse in Ephesians, and they would every once in a while say, Dad, you're so exasperating. It's like, because they're trying to use scripture to say, Dad, you've been called to you've been called to a higher calling. And I'm wondering if I'm relating that verse in Ephesians to this one here, that God's goal is to reconcile yes, maybe in a patriarchal culture, but certainly fathers who have a role in their homes to where their children are important, not just their jobs, not just the being at the gate or whatever it is, that their family is important to them.
By the way, I found out something about patriarchal cultures that I didn't know before. I found it out just recently. That actually in most patriarchal cultures, religious instruction is done primarily by the mother, and she's regarded as the religious authority. She has great stature, but inside the home, not outside the home.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I wonder though if we can project this to the, you know, it talks about the day of the Lord, and you know the day of the Lord is a day of great tumult, and you know I think it pictures a time where there is a coming together, maybe of believers, maybe of the whole planet, in anticipation of the day of the Lord. And I think that as we come to an end of these lessons here, that that's something that I think we should long for and pray for, is that in this broken world, the promised kingdom, that is a kingdom of righteousness where things are not broken, you know, if that would come. And I think that it's been true of Christians of every age that we long to see that in our time.
Well, and isn't it true that in the book of Acts, like when on the day of Pentecost, when Peter, at the end of his sermon, he said, actually, it's in the middle of it when people are saying that you all on the Pentecost, you guys look like you're drunk. And Peter says, how can we be drunk? It's 9 a.m. People don't usually get drunk unless it's at night. And he says, what you see is a fulfillment of the book of Joel, specifically quoting a passage that talks about the day of the Lord, that in that day, I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. And for Peter, the day of the Lord had arrived when Jesus died with the coming of the Messiah.
Yeah.
But certainly with Jesus' death, there was a great earthquake. The sky was darkened, right? There was a sense of judgment. The graves were opened. We read in Matthew, there was this resurrection, a small foreshadowing, right? Or first fruits. But and then the Holy Spirit is poured out. For Peter, the day of the Lord had begun. And so it makes me wonder, are we not then... should we not be really excited that, hey, it started then and we're still living in something approaching the conclusion of this great event, right? And maybe part of that great event is us figuring it out that we are on that day and it matters.
Yeah, the one scary piece to this is if you look at the other occasions where there was idolatry that turned toward belief, there was some tumultuous event, like the appearance of a prophet in a robe with a belt around his and I wonder if something like that might not happen again.
Well, certainly in Adventism, we can say that, Adventists would say that historically, you know, a judgment scene in the 1800s and a prophet arises to discuss it.
Yeah.
Well, what's going to happen just before Christ's return?
Yeah.
I think that was a foreshadowing, a local foreshadowing of something that's going to be far bigger.
Yeah.
So, you get Jonah and the five-word sermon. Five words in the whole city.
And actually, that's
repents. I think we may be surprised.
Yeah, that's another example we could have looked at.
Yeah.
Hey, well, thank you very much. We come to a conclusion here, not only of the lesson today, but of a whole quarter. And again, thank you for your participation and your liveliness and your collegiality and
it was fun.
Insights
thanks, Dave.
And all those things. My thanks to Brad Williams, our engineer who does work quietly behind us. And my thanks to those of you who faithfully listen to the Good Word, who check in with us once in a while for the Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas.